Yes, please.
Okay. Did I turn over to you? Okay, I'll turn the meeting over to Kristen Bauer and the rest of the revenue team to start the meeting.
Great, thanks, Russ. So we've got three topics today: constraints, licenses, and collectability. And as you all know, these have interrelationships between them, but we'll plan to go in order. So that first paper is paper A, 7A or 175A, and I'll turn it over to Brian for the TO.
Yeah, thanks. In September, the boards asked us to evaluate the objective of the constraint, whether or not we needed to add a confidence threshold, and whether or not we needed to reintroduce something similar to paragraph 85 from the 2011 ED for licenses and intellectual property. So we have assessed some alternative objectives in paragraphs 21 to 27 of the paper, which focus on the entity's ability to estimate. The first was whether the entity expects that its estimate would be significantly different from the amount that the entity is ultimately entitled to. And we found this to be very restrictive, which would have made it difficult to pass the constraint. Another one that we evaluated was whether or not the entity had the ability to reasonably estimate the variable consideration. And this was more of a process than an outcome, and we found it sort of difficult to apply a confidence threshold for that. So we assessed the confidence threshold in paragraphs 10 to 15 of the paper, and ultimately the staff are recommending that the boards retain the existing objectives with the specified level of confidence. And we have two questions in the paper. The first question is, do the boards agree with the objective of the constraint and the level of confidence as outlined in paragraph 56.1 of Appendix A? With respect to reassessment, we think it should generally be required in most cases because otherwise it would put significant pressure on the initial evaluation of the constraint. And in many overtime performance obligations, there are multiple sources of variability that are resolved by the entity's performance. But for performance obligations that are satisfied at a point in time with variable consideration and that cannot be estimated with a sufficient level of confidence for an extended period of time, the resolution of the uncertainty is often not linked to the entity's performance, and it's not resolved until sometimes a significant period of time later. So the staff have presented two alternatives with respect to reassessment. The first one, again, is similar to paragraph 85 from the 2011 ED. And to provide some additional thinking on that, the staff recently distributed a supplement to the paper, which you should all have. Alternative two would require an entity to estimate variable consideration and evaluate the constraint for all transactions. But if the entity failed the constraint, it would not reassess for performance obligations that are satisfied at a point in time. A clarification for this alternative is that an entity would also not include a minimum amount in the transaction price. If we allowed a minimum, then it would be very difficult to fail the constraint. So the staff recommend alternative one for reassessment. And the second question in the paper is, do the boards agree with the staff recommendation of alternative one in Appendix A that would require an entity to update the transaction price at each reporting date and include an exception to the constraint that would preclude an entity from including in the transaction price an estimate of sales or usage-based royalties for licenses of intellectual property until the customer's subsequent sales and usage occur? Okay. Why don't we start with the questions and debates here, and then the ISD can talk about questions and debates, and then we can call votes at that point. So does anybody have any questions or observations here? Mark, I thought you might have some.
On the first question on the objective, I disagree with the staff recommendation. I don't understand why it's better information to book minimums at every quarter for almost all kinds of contracts with customers. I've had this concern. I've raised it a number of times. I think as you guys went through in paragraph 32 and went through an example to show why you need to scope out the sales-based royalties, and you walk through why, the particular point is to note that revenues recognized in years 2 through 9 convey no information about the entity's performance and relate entirely to updates in the entity's estimate of the transaction price. And essentially, the revenue represents a series of true-ups. I think the exact same thing is going to happen if we go through your objective because I think the objective really is the objective that you're recommending is to book minimums. I think, you know, you go through a couple different paragraphs and then you get to paragraph 53 and it's basically your objective is to book a minimum. So I disagree with the objective that you guys have recommended.
Do you have a different objective?
The objective that they described after paragraph 24 is much closer in line with what I am, which is basically very consistent with where we were in the 2011 ED, which is if you can estimate, then sure, estimate it within the transaction price. And there's a list of factors, and if you pass those factors, then you can estimate. If you don't pass those factors, then you reassess.
And you are trying to estimate the total amount you're entitled to or the total amount you're entitled to based on performance to date?
Well,
point in time, that's the same, but in overtime, that's different.
Right. So if you're asking me would I ever book a minimum, I would book a minimum in two cases. One is if there's a guaranteed or a fixed amount, well, fixed or determinable amount.
Right.
The second is if you've estimated based on the most likely outcome scenario and you came up with a range, and no one number within the range is any more likely than the other, then I would take the minimum amount of that range. So that's the only two times a minimum. Because otherwise, the information is just not all that useful to an investor.
Okay. Anybody else? Hal?
I'm just going to say exactly where Mark is, so I'm not going to repeat everything you just said. We agree.
Okay. Tom?
I don't understand how that fixed the paragraph 32 problem. Because what will happen if you can't estimate it is when you can estimate it, when there isn't performance, you'll be recognizing revenue. So that's the paragraph 32 problem. You're talking about a different problem.
No. Well, the paragraph 32 issue is the same as we have today, which is at some point in time you will have some of the uncertainty resolved, and at that point you'd recognize revenue. So when it's sell in and sell through, and that happens today, and it's annoying as an analyst to deal with. Some companies start off on sell-through, right, waiting for something to get through the distribution channel until such time as they have enough history, and then they move to sell-in. And so you're right. In that quarter, it's really frustrating to deal with. However, from that point forward, at least you're on a consistent basis and you know where you are. Under the staff recommendation, every quarter it's basically a cookie jar of revenues management where you're able to just up your estimate a little bit to get any number that they might want to estimate.
So what's your fix?
Paragraph 24 has the objective, which is similar to where we were in the 2011 ED, which is you look at the factors, right, which we have in 56.2, and if you meet those factors, then you can estimate. If you don't meet those factors because it's based on your customer's customer or it's outside of your control or it's based on market variables, then you can estimate, then you wait until the uncertainty is resolved, unless you're in the two cases where I would book a minimum.
But the objective of your estimate is the ultimate amount you're entitled to based on performance to date. That's why I asked the question. So in other words,
I want to understand.
Yeah.
Your model is similar to statement 48 or other, you know, current practice.
Consistent with today.
But again, you're going to be recognizing revenue when you can estimate, not when the company performs.
Hopefully, it'll be much more closer to where the company performs. Under this model, every quarter, it has nothing to do with performance. It's just updating an estimate under the staff's recommendation.
So how would you evaluate sell-through?
Under sell-in or sell-through, I would evaluate it similar to what's done today, which is if you have the history, then you could estimate on sell-in and do it. If you don't have the history, then you got to wait to sell through.
Anybody else here?
I'm comfortable with the staff recommendations.
Okay.
The model that we're developing is one of primarily recognizing revenue when there is transfer of control to the customer. And there is one exception that we're building a constraint exception in circumstances, generally speaking, when there could be significant revenue reversal so that there would not be any bias in that revenue, even if you perform. I'm not comfortable with an objective of saying that you don't recognize it if you can't estimate it, both upside and downside. And that's what paragraph 24 starts talking about. You can't estimate it, both upside and downside, so that if you got an upside estimation problem, you are not going to recognize revenue, and that doesn't seem to be the issue. So that's why I like the objective in question one that emphasizes that you don't recognize revenue only when there's a downside problem in terms of the variable consideration. Paragraph 24 is upside and downside. But I like objective one for that particular reason. Now, if we're going to be talking about minimum and that particular concern, it would seem the way to deal with that perhaps would be to extend the exception that's just for licenses of intellectual property to all contracts and not change the objective to estimation problems of both upside and downside. Now, I don't know. I find that I'm willing to tolerate the exception for licenses of intellectual property because I really believe in those instances that's another instance where that's an indicator of a partnership between the seller and the buyer, and that partnership reflects that you're really having a license that's access over time. So I'm not real comfortable that this particular exception is characterized simply as a measurement exception over a variable consideration. I think it's an exception that deals with saying this is really an access setting, and that's where I can begin to support that.
Would you do that for point-in-time sales?
And I think the exception applies mostly to point-in-time when you have variable consideration.
Well, forget about but. I thought what you were saying was you wouldn't restrict it to just intellectual property.
I was saying if I were Mark, I'd be arguing don't.
Well, and that'll be my plan B. But expanding an exception, did not seem to me to be the place to start. Fixing the objective to me seems to be the place to start.
So I'm basically accepting the staff recommendations because I think it gets to licenses the way they ought to be by adding addition, however we package it, by adding a different criterion that gets over time as sailor usage occurs, revenue recognition in those settings. And I'm comfortable that reflects the economics. I'm not particularly comfortable about having three levels of revenue recognition criteria. Because what we have is performance, constrained by variable consideration, and then with a big exception, okay, if we do it for everything. And I'm willing to live with the exception, but I wouldn't put that exception in the general standard. I put it in the license's guidance because I think it's an override of both recognition and measurement in the presence of variable consideration in a certain contract. And the way it's written now, it's general guidance about variable consideration that's specific, and I don't think that is really what we're doing in alternative one. We're making an exception in licenses. It's not inconsistent with IG 37, which is the point-in-time overtime implementation guidance on licenses, being in a special area, because I don't see that really as an application of the general standard. I see that as very specific interpretation of what is being transferred in a unique setting, and I would see alternative one as a very specific, unique thing for licenses that doesn't create three ways of thinking about revenue recognition in a model, just a unique thing for licenses.
So can I ask you a question, Mark? Under your observation and your views about paragraph 24, do you think that the philosophy of what you do in an overtime contract today would where you have the ability to estimate what the amount you're ultimately entitled to, there'd be virtually no change in what you're proposing?
I think that's right.
And there'd be no change in the sell-in, sell-through today?
I think that's right.
Right, okay.
I think the problem that people had with the 2011 ED was that we used the words reasonably, one of the biggest problems was that we used the words reasonably assured,
right,
and then described it in the way that we have in paragraph 24 with A and B. And people said, well, you're using reasonably assured, which means something in U.S. GAAP, and now you're using it to mean something different. So they said, change that. And I thought that meant change the words reasonably assured. not change the whole model.
Okay.
I understand why this works for sell-in and sell-through and perhaps for licenses and intellectual property.
Okay.
But I don't understand. I think there's some potential unintended consequences of making this general.
Okay. So there's an observation from somebody about what Mark said. Is that you?
Well, yeah, just wanted to jump in. I think, you know, we understand Mark's views, but I think the struggle that we've had with reasonably assured or probable, it sets an expectation of an outcome versus the way 2011 ED set forth the requirements. It was, can you estimate? And so can you estimate is hard to assess if you're going to be probable. And so I think the way that we've understood the interpretation of the 2011 and 2010 EDs was people wanted greater certainty of when did I cross over the line? When is my estimation process good enough that I should include it, and when is it not? And so I think we really wanted to move in some direction like that, but you can't be probable of a process. You can be probable or reasonably sure of an outcome. And so that
I get that, and I understand that, and it's an issue with 48 today in around, you know, in the U.S. at least. Somehow they've been able to figure out when they have enough experience to make the switch.
Before I turn over to ISB, any other comments, thoughts here? No. Okay, Hans, why don't you, I'll turn over to you.
Okay. Who wants to open? We go?
Firstly, I should say I will not attend. And secondly, I hope we can finish early, like today. In our opinion, should be finished much earlier, but must be finished before the TK left. At least, you know. And on this, I want to offer you, you know, a consistent amount of different standards. In the leading standards, we propose, you know, in substance notion. And for me, I think we should be consistent. Particularly, TK yesterday during the education mentioned, you know, in some cases, hard to distinguish between, you know, pure intellectual property or others. And so, in my view, you know, keep consistency more important.
Okay.
I have nothing to add beyond my comments at the education session, and that was a public session. And I think that the staff, after considerable going back and forth, and after considerable thought, I think the alternative one will be addressing it. I do respect Tom's view about where it should be placed, the exception, and I supported him at the last board meeting, joint board meeting in September. But that to me is a placing issue, and the staff can show it in the staff draft how it fits in if it moves to implementation guidance, particularly in license. And I don't think that changes any of the answer that we are trying to achieve and to alleviate the tension that is often attended when you're dealing with the licenses, whether it is a license over time or point in time. That's the reason we got IG 37. And so by putting the sales-based exception, we do definitely take into consideration. And to Mark Siegel's comment about sell-in, sell-through, my experience is that it is almost difficult in situations when you are in a sell-in mode to switch to sell-through and vice versa. And most companies, from my experience, especially in semiconductor and other places, that sell-through is the way to go. And I think Tom said this point, it moves away from you from the point of transfer of control. And I think I do accept that this solution, alternative one, would require sell-in, sell-through distinction to be removed. And those people have to estimate it, unless they are a license situation. And I think that is the small price to pay, and it fits into the overall model. And this is exactly the reason why we have this project in first place, is to bring the disparate accounting practices into one place. And so I really feel that the past considered view, after going through so many iterations, is a very elegant and perhaps acceptable solution. So I think I will vote for it, and I'll recommend others to vote for it.
Gary?
I also support the staff's recommendation. When I think about reading some of the words in paragraph 56.1, and they were the estimate and variable. So I think we need to keep in mind we're dealing with a certain degree of unknown and a certain degree of imprecision. When you sort of put that in mind, you're never going to have a perfect solution. We're just going to have a solution that's doable. Or workable or implementable. And when I start thinking about the purpose of financial statements, putting as a preparer or controller's hat on, one of the things you want is the balance sheet always to be viewed as protected. And keeping your minimum to an amount that's not likely to be reversed, I think, is a good objective of the balance sheet. It gives a certain degree of comfort, at least what you see is in fact there. You're trying to minimize the risk of something declining and going adverse against what you book. So I think given, a couple of years of work on this thing and going around the clock and around the field a few times, I think we need to understand that there's not going to be a better answer there. And I think protecting the balance sheet in of itself, if no other reason, would be a good thing.
Doug?
Yes, thank you. Can I ask a question about the supplement paper which was delivered today? Because in the education section, we didn't see the paper. So I appreciate you provided the reason why exception is limited to license. But to me, it doesn't really look like, the reason for limitation. It only tells us that the reason why a license should be exception. So I understand licenses should be exception from all your three reasons. However, it doesn't tell us why others cannot be exceptions. Because in July's meeting, in our paper 7C, you showed some example which has similar nature with the license. That was the mineral deposit case. In the case of mineral deposit, then it's like a kind of usage type, royalty type. So it's almost similar to this license property, but para 85 does not cover such a product. So if you try to explain why you limit to the license, you have to answer why mineral deposit is not out of the scope.
Sure, and I can take it, and Brian and Kristen, you can chime in if you want as well. I think the supplement, we tried to just pull together a quick summary of a lot of the rationale that we've been building up over time on this. I think we have touched on it a little bit in the first paragraph, but I think licenses is really the one case where we found that there isn't, if the entity performs up front, but the variability extends for a significant length of time. And it's that uncertainty, and because that uncertainty is so great, it takes so long to resolve itself. That's why we felt that we needed to limit it to licenses. And you bring up a good point about the mineral rights. I think here we were just thinking of trying to scope it such that it didn't apply to too many things, because if an entity can estimate things, I think we want them to estimate things. And this goes back to a few of the points made about performance and can control. Mm-hmm. I think this is the one case where we felt that the information just wasn't helpful, it wasn't useful.
Can we take question one and two together? Are we happy to read the staff recommendation?
Fifteen.
Over to you, Russ.
Okay, thanks.
Why don't I take them separately, because I think there may be differences of opinion on objective question one. So we've got two alternatives here. One is the staff's recommendation. The other is Mark's amendment, which would reference the objective in paragraph 24. So let me first start with the objective as articulated in paragraph 24. That's Mark's amendment versus the staff recommendation. So those who are in support of the objective in paragraph 24, please raise your hand. Okay, that's two. Those in support of the staff recommendation, please raise your hand. Okay, that's four. And one board member is abstaining because this is the first time he's dealt with this project. Right? Okay.
So do you have a majority then?
Yes, I have four. We can move on.
Is that question two, though?
So let me move on to question two. Okay. In question two, who's in favor of the staff's recommendation? Tom? Go ahead.
I am in favor, but I'd like to change the location of where that exception
okay.
goes.
All right. We can deal with that. Who's in favor of the staff's recommendation? Still four? You're not in favor of the staff's recommendation?
No, now that I lost the other vote, I wanted to extend the, I would have expanded the exception to
all,
all point in time.
Okay. Same basis for you, Hal? All right. Good. So four in favor with the staff's recommendation on question two. Yeah, Tom?
A couple minor points that aren't really substantive related to these issues. One of the things that have been raised by commentators on this particular process is whether or not when reading the guidance, people will understand that they would apply the thought process to each separate type of variable consideration separately rather than collective variable consideration. The way it's written right now, it reads as if there is variable consideration, one big lump, and there might be in contracts several different types of variable consideration. So I'd ask the staff to consider making that clear by perhaps putting after the word amount, a parens S, amount, so that it would be clear that do the evaluation separately if there's multiple variable considerations.
Yes, and I would say that's our intent by including some but not all of the variable considerations.
And then I thought Mark brought up a very good drafting issue last time when he suggested that the language in 56.2 and 56.3 are all about factors as to when you estimate a minimum. And right now it sort of feels like there's one set of factors about whether it's estimable and the second one to think about a minimum. I think it might be easier to communicate if we sort of combine the notion there like he discussed in the Ed session.
Is that what you want to bring up? Okay. Well, you want to move on to licenses? Let's clean that up.
Natasha will tee that up. So, okay, for 7B is licenses. And as you'll remember, last month the boards eliminated a number of potential paths forward for licenses. The boards confirmed their decision to differentiate between the two types of licenses and asked the staff to clarify the criteria. The staff developed the criteria and received some feedback from external reviewers. And that feedback has been incorporated into the criteria that you'll see in the paper. So just as a quick reminder, paper 7B proposes clarification for the criteria. And as I mentioned at the education sessions, the main area where the staff would like the board's input is in paragraphs 9 to 12, which is on the intent of the criteria. The table in paragraph 11 outlines the main objectives of each of the criteria, which are anchored in whether the intellectual property is static or dynamic, and the interaction between those three criteria. Criterion C focuses on the effect of the dynamic intellectual property on the customer, while Criterion A focuses on the cause for why that intellectual property is dynamic. Criterion D reiterates that what makes the intellectual property dynamic is not a performance obligation itself. So with that, I'll turn it over to the boards with the question, do the boards agree with the intent of the criteria shown in paragraph 9 to 12?
Natasha, I agree with the staff's recommendation. I wanted to I guess, clarify something just to make sure I understand, though. In terms of the language that you're introducing in IG 37, and particularly IG 37A, my understanding here is you're directing the preparer of the financial statements, the reporting entity, to focus on those activities that have the most significant, and I'm going to borrow from words from IFRS 10 here in our control model, those activities that have the most relevant bearing, if you will, on the ability to use and obtain the benefits of the IP. Is that a fair conclusion?
I think what we're saying here is, and apologies, I'm not as close to IFRS 10, but I think what we're saying here is that when the entity undertakes activities that means that the IP will change over time.
But not just any activities, right? I mean, they're clearly the ones that are the most relevant to the functionality of what they're using, right?
They have to affect the IP. So they have to sort of affect
therefore
the IP.
Their control of the IP.
Well, what it means is the customer actually on day one, they don't have something that they can sort of fully control throughout the period because
right.
They basically can only get access to it each day.
Right.
It's like a latest and greatest. But each day they must use the most recent version of that IP. So the entity has done something to change that over time.
That makes complete sense to me. I guess I just think it's more, that message is delivered more subtly than I think it should be. And I think you should actually refer to, you know, the kinds of activities that bear on their functionality, ability to use and control, as opposed to right now. I think it's kind of an amorphous kind of thing. We say entities' customary business practices, published policies, specific statements. That kind of, in my mind, is dancing around the real issue. So if you tighten that up, I think it makes a lot of sense to me.
Great. That will take that up.
Amado? Thanks, sir. It's probably a follow-up of Ned's session with regards to criteria. I do agree with the direction of the paper. Just during the Ned's session, I propose that the criteria C would actually be better placed together, linked with criteria A, because they are, of course, as you stated, very much related. So I suggested that the aspect of rights granted and the risks associated with those rights would fit better as one criteria only in criteria C, and also comment that I wouldn't consider or include the intention at this stage as in the criteria as something key. So I know that session was yesterday, and you probably didn't have time to think about that, but I guess this in my view is important to provide more clarity in the criteria.
I'm quite happy with the direction. As I said, the session also communicated to the staff, I think the IG drafting can be further improved. There are a couple of drafting points. And there is, I think, regarding also criterion C under IG 37, I think it's a bit overly restrictive. Let's assume there is an understanding between the licensor and the licensee. The licensor will undertake a certain level of advertising expenses, advertising campaigns throughout the duration of the contract. The customer is exposed to the result of this activity, but the wording here says as on when. As on when seems to convey a notion of immediate impact of the activities on the customer. I think advertising never has an immediate impact. It takes some time for the advertising to pay back. So I think the as on when is a bit too restrictive and would kick out for criteria a number of activities which I think should trigger an over time recognition of the royalty.
I support that proposal. I feel, you know, we may seem a little bit complicated. The base my understanding is like this. You have a license plus some service. If based on revenue standards you can clearly separate, then you should account for separately.
based on the standard. And if it is distinct, you know, I would view, you know, a couple like a point of time. The issue we now propose by the staff is something in between. That is, there are some services integral in the license. And it is easy to distinct, to separate. And so the staff proposed, if it is significant, if not significant, we should not account for overtime. If it is significant, it should be account for overtime. I accept. But on the one hand, we say you have significant involvement and you will have activities. But on the other hand, we also say you don't have performance obligations. I feel hard to understand. You know, to say there's no separate performance obligation, this is separate example agreement. But in this case, you still have the performance obligation. The contract will clearly say you have to do something. Otherwise, how the other side are willing to pay you? So my sense is to make it much, much clear, straightforward, not make things so complicated. Particularly, that on the one hand, we say you have significant involvement, you provide activities, but on the other hand, we say you do not have performance obligations. It's hard to understand. So I think to be make the budget straightforward and clear. It looks like, you know, just these things so complicated.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think we were just trying to articulate a decision from last November that there are, you know, some licenses that even after you've separated the performance obligation, there's something going on there. And, you know, certainly we can try to improve the drafting, but I think that's what we're getting at. So that's what we're trying to get at with this drafting.
My suggestion, I think it's a brief suggestion yesterday. You know, both right to use and access are right. Mm-hmm. It seems, you know, my heart translates into Chinese at least. Access means what? You know, both of them are right.
Okay. First of all, I support the fundamental decision that the staff has reflected here, that there are two types and that we should be trying to identify characteristics that help us separate the whatever label, set of labels we attach to it, point in time versus over time. And I think the staff has moved things along from the previous discussion in terms of on the point Wade Bull was raising, that this comes after you have identified distinct performance obligations that have to be accounted for as separate performance obligations. So that, and I think we just have to keep challenging ourselves to make sure that we've got it absolutely clear that this is not an alternative route, but rather comes later on. One question that I had in terms of the characteristic, given the decision that we just took on the previous paper, if you look at criterion A, I'm just not sure that we need the one about existence of shared economic interest, for example, a sales-based royalty, because we just reached a conclusion that says if you have that for a license of IP, this is what you do, and I'm not sure that it's relevant in terms of saying, have I delivered everything I have to deliver or not? I think the focus of the search criterion should be, have I completed the performance? So I just, it's that one bit, and it's a bit more than drafting, but it's not a fun, it's fundamentally agreement with this, but just questioning one example.
Sure, certainly you can take that away.
Okay. Well, hold on, can I get in there? Sorry, but Mary, you might have situations where the licenses are, the payment is fixed up front, and then you have a sales-based royalty on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take it out, it the fact that there is an ongoing partnership relationship may be a characteristic of an access situation. And so I'm not, I just think there's situations where granted, if it was all sales-based, it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't need to draw a distinction, but there could be cases where the payment is both fixed and sales-based, and you'd have to make a judgment as to what to do with the fixed base.
And Russ, I did sit down and think of that, and I guess I can see all four permutations are possible, that you have a point in time with a fixed component and a sales-based component, and you have an overtime with a fixed and variable. And so I think we do have to distinguish, you know, we still have to distinguish point in time from overtime before we think about how we account for the sales-based piece. But, and let's say we had fixed, if you conclude it's point in time, then the fixed piece will still be recognized at that point in time. Even though you're recognizing as the customer makes sales or as there's usage for the sales-based piece, if you have overtime, if your conclusion is it delivers access, you're going to be, even though you have a fixed payment, I think you would say that then gets recognized as you provide the access, not upfront, even if it were paid upfront. So I agree with you in terms of it's still relevant to think about the type, but to me the notion of shared interest is not relevant to the assessment of control, which is the fundamental principle that we have. And going back to what Tom was saying about I think it was in the previous paper, if we're creating the sales-based exception, I do want to constrain it, and I think it doesn't feel to me like it's part of the control assessment, which is why I was questioning it as a criterion for separating overtime from point in time.
CK?
A couple of things. I'm glad that Mary and Russ spoke about if there is a fixed amount and a variable amount, which I felt that at the education session there was a thinking that upfront is recognized immediately, and there. I think we need to consider it, and I don't think the staff can provide any more than what it has already provided to distinguish it. I think the criteria is good rather than us giving enough guidance on this, because I got an email, somebody giving me 8 scenarios how to do those in a sales-based royalties, and we already have it, and there's no way we can stop these things. So I think the criteria that we have is good. A couple of things I just want to make sure that we are not losing track of it. I think Pat made a point about perhaps it is too subtle that needs to be alleviated, and I think the way to alleviate in my mind is in a couple of ways. One is that perhaps the words dynamic and static are too pejorative, and I think the intent needs to be more explained. You want to put AKA dynamic or something, that's fine. At least that's allowed in drafting. But I think we need to explain what we are trying to do. And to Damaro's point, that I completely agree with Damaro's point, and I think Gary also raised this at the education session, is that the key criteria needs to be very clearly explained to the key of that Natasha made about the effect of it. It's not all the activities of the licensor are relevant to making the conclusion whether that is a overtime or a point in time. And to the point that Allison made, it is what, if you are not allowed to get anything other than the latest draft or latest version, and you cannot use yesterday's version once this is released, and that's contractually required or something like that, which is very often in the case in trademarks or Disney licensing its products or something like that. That's what we are really after, and I think this eminently does it. Last point I want to make is that the rationale that the staff draft should not be lost in the background of BC's basis of conclusion, but that needs to be elevated to you in the body of the standard or implementation guidance. I am not an expert in that, but we definitely need to make sure that we keep that.
I think if you do that, I think it's a workable solution. We could stick it together after 1 year also. It's a great achievement.
Thank you, PK. Over to you, Russ.
Larry? So I think this has been a very difficult area because different people view the economics of these transactions very differently. We have currently people in different industries that economically have very similar transactions that account for them differently, and we're trying to come to some kind of cut. And we've taken various swipes at it, and we've settled on this. While I personally don't necessarily agree with where we've drawn the line or people's interpretations, my concerns are more with making sure that people can apply the standard consistently. And that's the objective. I think, consistent with some of the remarks of IASB members, I think it's very important that some of the words that are in blue in your memo under rationale be incorporated in the standard itself someplace. I think this one area, I would err on the side of putting too much in the standard and less in the basis. You know, if you have a choice, because I think it will be helpful to people. And I also think that we need some other examples. I've said several times, I think we need the TV syndication example where there's a show in production versus a show that's out of production, and the fact that you would get different recognition methods under those. I think the... The royalty for the use of, for the Boston Red Sox when they win the series tonight. that would be a
good
example.
Now you're not going to get a house vote. Right there.
that would be a good example because I think there are people that would legitimately interpret that differently. But if we put the examples in, people will understand better the notion of shared economic interest. Like Allison described it before, and she couldn't even put words to it. She goes, you just know there's something else going on. So we need as much as possible so people understand when to recognize that something else is going on. Anybody else? Tom?
I just want to pile on and agree with Larry. I think I would recommend the staff, when they look at the rationale in paragraph 11, err by putting more of it into the standards and less. But certainly to make the criteria understandable, or each criterion understandable, the rationale is really what brings it out and makes it far more easy to apply. You've got examples embedded in some of the rationale discussion here, so that might be a form of basis for thinking about items that you could put in implementation guidance to help people understand what each of the criterion mean.
Mark?
I think you've taken this a far bit better than where it had been in the past. I think it's much better along. It clicked for me with paragraph 10, what's in italics in paragraph 10, where you describe the license, the access license, as getting access to the intellectual property as it exists at the time the customer accesses the IP, as opposed to what you got on day one. That really clicked with me, at least, and so I would encourage you to use that verbiage throughout. I like how you elevated the discussion about making sure you go through step two of the model first and identify all the different performance obligations before you come through here. I agree with everybody who said include the rationale section. I think criterion B is a little bit of belts and suspenders. And I guess I wouldn't necessarily argue to take it out, but I think if you do step two right and you identify all the different performance obligations right, you know, hopefully you don't need criterion B, but it is helpful as you describe the rationale to show how it all fits together.
So I'm sensing broad support for the philosophy and the editorial improvements here. Recognize there's some other edits. So just by show of hands, when I look at the question, does the FASB agree with the direction that this is leaning? So, yeah. Okay, that's six in favor and one abstention. So I'll turn it back over to you, Hans, for a vote.
Okay. Do we support the direction that the staff has been heading into?
So, Weigu, we were going to take a break, but in your desire to get done early, why don't we continue? Okay. So I'm going to turn it over to Kristen to lead us through collectability.
Okay. So paper C is our last topic on collectability. And as you know, and as we talked about it in the Ed session, I think it is very important to understand the history of this as we've moved through the project. So we've provided a bit of that through the background section, as well as outlining the proposals that you have and your tentative decisions to date. And I think it's helpful to just highlight again that there's two places that this kind of comes into play. First, in our step one, sort of getting into the model, that gating issue, as well as in measurement. And we're not suggesting when we talk about the collectability threshold that it's a measurement change. And so it's important to kind of keep thinking about those two things. So we have two potential options on the table here, the first of which we would recommend in either case. So there are, based on the feedback that we heard, some drafting improvements that we could make that really, I think, increase some of the drafting to help hopefully simplify and get the intent a bit clearer for people. And so those drafting improvements we've outlined in a table on page 10. And they're largely some changes to what we have in paragraph 12E and deletion of the concept of enforcement and refining the commitment aspect there. And then referring people into paragraph 50, which starts some of the discussion about price concessions and some of your decisions related there. And then I think we are suggesting some improvements to the drafting that we previously had set forth in paragraphs 53.2 and 53.3. So that suggestion, all of those changes, we're recommending completely, regardless of what decision you make. So that's really the first question that we'll ask, is whether or not you agree with those drafting suggestions. Then the second question that we'll ask is whether or not those suggested improvements are enough, and that's after we make those, that would be sufficient. And that would be alternative A, and that is outlined on page 12, really in paragraph 19, suggests some of the reasons why that rationale would be supported. Then the remainder of the paper walks through the introduction of a collectability threshold, and that starts on page 13 in paragraph 20. And we walked through a number of very critical aspects of this model, and I think as we've been contemplating it, thinking about when the threshold should apply, how it should apply, its interrelationship with significant financing components, interaction with the constraints, and then sort of the drafting as we would put that in. And again, just to reiterate, it is sort of a gating issue, so we're thinking about it as part of step one into the model. And so the staff recommendation is laid out in paragraphs 41 and 40-43, really the two parts. First, we suggest the drafting improvements that we've outlined here, and the staff do recommend introducing the collectability threshold that we have outlined kind of through that second part of the paper. There's some examples in Appendix B, and also Appendix A walks through the drafting that we would be suggesting in the two alternatives. I said that wrong. Actually, Appendix A has some of the current accounting that has threshold. I think Appendix B is what has the – actually, I reversed that again. Current guidance is in B. A is our drafting. With that, if I haven't confused you,
okay,
I'll turn it over.
All right. Why don't we start here, and then we can turn it over to you. Any observations or questions? Hal looks like he's antsy, so here we go.
Not antsy, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time repeating everything we talked about in the Ed session. I disagree with the removing the intend to enforce. I thought that was an important element. It was initially put into the proposal to stop you from papering a contract to derive and manage revenues. And I thought that was an important add. We're taking it out. I understand why you're taking it out from the second part by inserting collectability. So it's not going to surprise anyone. I actually disagree with both aspects, both the taking it out and inserting a collectability issue.
preference is to keep the.
I would. I'm okay with B and C. I would not make the change in A.
Okay.
Okay. And then I'm not. Well.
And you would not do a threshold.
I would not do any threshold.
All right.
And in case you're not clear on that, I think that we are masking performance. We're separating performance between when you do something and when you ultimately recognize the revenue. And I think that actually complicates the analysis that investors will have to go through.
How do you reconcile that with your view on the constraint?
I view it as exactly the same thing. Anytime you start to constrain something, you push revenue into the future. Here, we're actually not pushing into the future. We're actually saying, no, it wasn't revenue. Now, if you ultimately collect more than you initially booked, then you've, in effect, delayed it there. So in both cases, I see you separating revenue recognition from some level of performance.
Okay. Tom?
I'm supportive of both staff recommendations, and in particular, I'm very supportive of the threshold. I believe it's primarily a recognition problem, though there is a little bit of a presentation issue that's correlated with it. Why I think we started this journey thinking about variable consideration as comprised of all the things we talked about in Memo A and credit risk. And then through the journey, we've decided that credit risk is a special form of variable consideration that needs special presentation. And that's complicated the model very significantly. And what we've gone through that process then is to end up saying, if we don't have a threshold, we get into the whole discussion that if you've got significant credit risk at the inception of the contract, whether that's a price concession or not, and if it is a price concession, the bad debt ends up going into the revenue line, the credit risk ends up going through the revenue line throughout the contract, which seems to me to override those of you that have been supporting bad debts being separated from anything but revenue. So I think there's an advantage, a twofold advantage over the threshold. One, it continues the variable consideration we decided here into credit risk by not having revenue be affected if there's a chance of a significant revenue reversal. That's not how we're saying it, but not having revenue affected by having that threshold when there's significant credit risk. Rather than turning around and letting revenue be grossed up for this form of variable consideration and having a really large bad debt expense down below. And I just don't see that as a consistent way to think about variable consideration. Second of all, I'm deeply concerned that if we don't have a threshold, we get all this confusion about price concessions, credit risk being tantamount to a price concession. That's a really ugly baby. And the second thing that ends up happening is we do not end up getting in bad debt some of the most significant credit risk if it's a price concession. And I don't understand the decision to have a separate bad debts line item. If the most significant credit risk at an inception goes into the revenue line, what bad debts is telling us? Now, I recognize there's still one final inconsistency, that if you have a significant financing component, the bad debts goes into the revenue line. I don't see an easy fix to that. The only fix to that would be to try to remove the credit risk out of the discount rate, but to have someone move forward to, first of all, have to come up with a discount rate and then estimate what the credit risk is in the discount rate other than and not say it's a risk-free rate is just too ugly of a thing for me to contemplate moving forward. So for those reasons, I support the staff recommendation for a threshold. I actually think the threshold should be the same as the variable consideration threshold because it's an application of the variable consideration concept.
Yeah.
I also agree with the staff recommendations, including the threshold. I share Tom's observation that I wish that it was the same threshold as we use for constraint. And just an observation for highlighting purposes that, you know, even though we're using the same words here, the word probable means something different in the respective sets of standards. And so effectively, we will not be converged on the level of the collectability threshold. So just an observation.
Yeah, the only additional point, I agree with the staff drafting changes. I agree with inclusion of the threshold. I agree with making it probable, as historically has been defined in U.S. GAAP. I think that'll make it easier as companies and auditors deal with this to be able to not have to fully judge, is it a price concession or a credit issue? I think if there's a different threshold, there's an additional judgment as to what actually this is. But if it's the same threshold throughout, then I think it'll be easier to apply. And I think that was one of the things that came out in some of our outreach between the last time we dealt with this issue and this time. So before I turn over, any other points anybody wants to make?
Just on that last point, I think that as you go through cycles, product cycles, economic cycles, we're going to be masking concessions and credit exposure into a single number, into Tom's point, and then burying it someplace. So I think there's a tremendous amount of lost content here. So it troubles me that we hear in one project impairment where we do not want to combine numbers. We want them separated, but here we're making exactly the opposite decision. I know that people view revenue differently than net interest income, but it's still the same issue.
That's not my point. Your earlier vote was to do a vote of an objective for a sell through, which would have delayed it until you knew the cash you were going to get. So I don't understand that vote and this point.
Yeah, I guess I just view that performance a little bit differently than I do this broader issue. No, I was willing on the narrow issue to go along with that.
Okay. Tom?
I just want to recognize that I thought that Martin raised a good point in their Ed session, where he indicated that the way we described the probable threshold in 12F could be interpreted as saying that if you know you're not going to collect 2% of the revenue at the start, that it's not probable of collecting all, which is sort of a different, in contrast to what we have in paragraph 53.2B, which sort of really takes the opposite side, that the problem arises when you have significant doubts about the customer's performance. I just think that the staff needs to be able to think about how to write 12F so that it doesn't encompass minor credit, known credit risk, but more significant doubt sort of situation.
I didn't attend the Ed session, but maybe I can ask Martin. Your point about the 2%, was that on a portfolio or a contract by contract? Because I think this analysis is a transaction by transaction. So I thought the philosophy was you think it's probable of collection because you have no indication that you won't receive it, but on a pool, you recognize you're going to lose 2%. In that case, I think you recognize revenue, you have a 2% impairment.
Well, that would be a good way of clarifying it. I still don't see that the language in F grabs.
My question is, am I thinking about that right, and was that the scenario that Martin was bringing up?
My point was both. I think it was in a single transaction, but also I think it was related to a portfolio.
Okay.
And the question, and really my concern was about if it is really minor credit risk involved, that we don't, without this wording, then really restrict then from revenue recognition. And it could be on a portfolio case, but it was also on a single transaction case. That was my concern, and that we have to change the wording, that we don't really exclude situations where we have, for example, with high probability that we can collect maybe 98% of the agreed price, that we don't then exclude that kind of transactions from recognition. That was my point.
And we don't need that price.
So I think it was what I heard was mostly about a portfolio setting rather than an individual contract setting, but you could potentially get to the individual contract view.
But on an individual contract view, that could easily, that was my point about a price concession. When you, did you give a price concession or is it credit? And that's why I thought it was really important to have the same threshold there.
Because if you're going to collect 98%, why not 100? Are you just conceding $2? Because they could still pay it, but so is it a concession or is it credit?
But let me turn over to you, Hans.
Okay, thank you, Russ. So who on the prudence threshold?
Yeah, I think this is a classical case of accounting prudence. It's not neutral. Sort of a conservatism.
I'm not going to discuss whether it is prudence or common sense or whatever, or faithful representation. Now, I have the same question as Martin has, how to apply this concept of collectibility on a sufficient degree of confidence, highly or probable, to a portfolio, a mass transactions business where you know by experience statistically that you collect from 90% of the customers pay and 10% don't pay. At the portfolio level, you have this high confidence level to collect. But if you go to the unit of account as a contract, you may not know which one will pay or will not pay. So how do we in practice apply this collectivity threshold to portfolios? That's the only question I have. Otherwise, I can live with the approach to have a collectivity threshold, especially if it is for convergence purposes, because I'm not convinced we need to have it, but I can live with it. But I'd like to know how it works on portfolios.
I'll just respond. I think it's a good question. I think the way that we have drafted paragraph 12 is more on a contract by contract basis. I think remember that the threshold is probable. So you'd be thinking, well, is it more like from an NFC perspective? Is it more likely than not that I'll collect this amount? I think if you have a large portfolio of really bad credits, you'd be thinking about that on an individual contract-by-contract basis. I think just to clarify Martin's point, and sort of to PK, I think sort of just mentioned it as well, we weren't intending, this is the contract sort of that Martin mentioned, that there's just a small percentage of an amount that you may not collect, but we're not intending to capture those as a threshold. So we'll try to address that in the wording as best we can. I think, I think that's what we intended, and that's, we need to perhaps update the drafting to try and address those points.
And to clarify my point, I think this assessment where you have maybe, if you don't collect 100%, maybe you collect 98% is done on a portfolio basis. That was my point. But we have to apply this revenue recognition standard to an individual transaction point. And if you have really concluded that on a portfolio, on all customer base, you will only collect 97% of your entitled amount, then it should not lead to that you cannot recognize revenue because, okay, it is not probable that you will collect 100%. That was really my point. And now that fits together because this assessment on credit risk is done on a portfolio level, not on a customer-by-customer basis. But your revenue recognition is done on an individual transaction. And that was only my point, and should not then...
But I think Jim Croker made a point here, is that if it's an individual transaction, and you're sure of collecting 98, and you're going to leave $2 on the table, whatever it is, and I think he questioned whether it is really a credit issue or a price concession, and I tend to think in that situation it's a price concession. You have given up on something, but...
Then you have already given up, and then you should do that, right?
Yeah, you have already given up, and you...
Can I interrupt here? I think we are not talking about the same fact pattern. Here, PK, you talk about a situation where you collect 98 out of 100 for one given customer. What we are talking about, Martin and I, is when you have a population where out of 100 customers, 2 or 10, in my case, will not pay at all, and 90 or 98 will pay.
That's right. But I think the point Alison is making is that when you statistically evaluate each individual contract, you still conclude that each individual contract, it was probable. You will end up, if it's not a price concession, you'll end up with revenue of 100 and a bad debt of 2, on the portfolio. But so you'd have to have, as I said to Martin on Monday, you'd have to have very strange evaluation of the cash flows in the individual contract before you ruled that it didn't meet the probability threshold.
That's fine. It's fine with me, but I like to see those words be brought into the standard, to the guidance.
John? Well, I don't mind having a collectability threshold. I think it's not a big issue, really, because in most cases, people are not crazy. And when they are crazy or dishonest, there are other things that must rule that. If you have a low-margin product and you have a high credit risk, you won't ship until you have secured payment, credit insurance, or LC, whatever you have. And if you have a very, very high-margin product,
well, then you take certain risks. If you have a bad customer with a low margin and you give a credit, then you raise your margin to offset part of the risk. And I think that will take care of most of these things. The benefit of having this threshold is that when you talk to external people, they know that you have at least certain restrictions. And there I think it makes sense. So I'm happy to support your proposal.
May go?
Don't worry, it's PK.
I'm not supporting. It seems awkward, you know, as I say during education session, you know. I don't like overnight change. We expose, debate so many times. Our constituency generally supports, but not includes
the threshold.
And we suddenly change, say we won't bring back. And I don't like sudden change. As I say, I observe, part of the case, sudden change may make finally pull, they make big mistake. And secondly, you know, I would like we accumulate our conclusions based on good proposals. I remember up to May, we already made all the proposals. But then the problem comes from the judge. And we introduce price concession and also take into consideration credit risk. And paragraph 14 clearly tells us people generally not support us. And I think we should support people, the positive suggestions, and they say you should not mingle with the two factors. And then further on, you know, the staff provide very, very, you know, strong reasons for us not have the credibility. That is discussed in long paragraph, that is paragraph 19. And from that paragraph, I feel very hard why the staff finally propose something which they should not propose. You know, paragraph 19 very clearly says, you know, if we not propose this threshold, you know, what are those benefits? And I feel hard, you know, to reject on that basis. And next one is, you know, staff says, you know, threshold will be used as a gate. You know, I feel doubt, you know, the debate or discussion between Martin and others clearly shows, you know, most of the time, you know, traditional threshold used not as a gate, as a measurement. You know, means if you have 100 transactions, your overall assessment is 5% you cannot get. And there are variants of different risk. And then you book the 100 revenue transactions and recognize either, you know, net amount of the revenue, or you recognize full amount of the revenue and recognize five, the bad expense. And I'm not sure, you know, we clearly say this is a gate. In reality, will be applied by this way. I don't think so. And finally, we recently published conceptual framework DP. In the DP, we clearly propose not use threshold. And of course, we should not say that this proposal is based on proposed DP or conceptual framework. But I will feel hard, you know, if we decide to reintroduce threshold, and we will feel very hard to conclude in the new conceptual framework, we will not have the threshold.
Okay.
I think Vegu raised this issue in the head session, and I just wanted to maybe not take too much liberties here, but I just want to say that I don't think the
the explicit recognition of probability threshold is a new concept, and I want to be very cautious because I don't want to give anybody listening to this call, or to us as board members, and to me more in particular, that this is a new concept. The aspect about probability is inherent and embedded in the earlier draft and earlier decision. And I think Mary brought up this issue about commercial substance and in the last education session. So I don't want people to think about saying that this is a brand new concept you're bringing. Perhaps if you put a higher probability threshold, maybe there are questions whether that is a new concept we are introducing. But leaving it at a probability threshold, whilst there is whether it should be there or not is a debate, but I would say that the aspect is not new to this. So I feel that on balance, personally, whilst I did raise this question in the ed session about in the significant financing situation where the discount rate already includes the credit adjusted, having a probability threshold is, I don't know what to do when the significant uncertainty is resolved. What do you do with the rate, what guidance we give, and whether that is the right thing, should we break it, and all that good stuff. But on balance, I think, I feel that having an explicit probability threshold is not, I can live with it.
I suppose the way Go has a very good point that in itself it's not very elegant to introduce a new concept in the post-deliberation stage that we are in. Well, we reopened, but it is bringing back something that not been there in most of our deliberations. And for that very reason, it's very important that the threshold itself is recognizable to the users and that it is not higher or lower than what is presently being used. And that's why we have to stick to probable, otherwise we really run a lot of risk. Daryl.
I guess I just wanted to pick up on one or two of the issues that we started with when Fazi was talking. The first thing I guess that was important for me is that I do see a fairly distinct difference between what the constraint is trying to capture and what the connection threshold is trying to capture. For me, the constraint is about saying whether or not you really do have an entitlement to the amount. And you're testing the value of the actual thing that you have sold to somebody. The collection threshold is about something different. It's about who you have sold it to. And I think those are two fairly distinct measures. So for me, it makes a big difference the way you look at it. So I was comfortable with where we got the constraint. I think the constraint answer is the right one in terms of what we have sold.
The collectability is about
the collectability of the entitlement. The collectability is now about something different. It's about
whether they have an entitlement
and
in
addressing the
sufficiently high quality.
In then thinking about the collectability, I had a lot of sympathy with what Hal was saying. I think collectability, by putting the collectability number, the amount that I'm entitled to on the face of the income statement, and then separately the amount by which I have to pay that because of the quality of the person to whom I sold it, I'm getting a lot of information content. So on the face of it, the answer that I would say is we should have no threshold. We should effectively recognize everything once we determine that we're entitled to it. At the same time, and I think this is a little bit of Jan's point, I also recognize that if I am more likely than not to receive the amount, there's something not happening. So I can accept that those transactions, when I'm more likely than not to receive it, are a special class of transactions in which something peculiar is going on, and in that circumstance I can justify to myself that it's an appropriate threshold. But as soon as I move to the point where I am more likely than not to actually receive the amount, it seems really peculiar to me that I'm not going to show on my income statement. I'm going to ignore, from the perspective of revenue, something in a circumstance where I'm more likely to receive it. So I think the threshold, as we have expressed it from the perspective of this document, I'm very comfortable with. I think it does. I do still see it as a compromise. I still prefer not to have a threshold at all, but I think it's an acceptable compromise. I think moving beyond it to the next threshold, to the higher threshold, is one I'm uncomfortable with.
Mary?
I don't think we need, but I don't object to introducing a threshold. If I look at the drafting of Appendix A, paragraph 12E, the language that we had and we were going to retain, that parties are committed to perform their respective obligations. I think going back to Kristen's TIA, we have to remember and express this in a way that it's clear that this is a gating issue. It's turning what could be with a qualitative assessment of are they committed to perform their respective obligations and saying, by the way, this includes a basic collectability, which is why I tied to probable, which is our existing conceptual framework. So to me, it's converting that qualitative assessment. But remembering the importance of this being getting to ask the basic question, you know, Jan, are people doing something stupid here or odd? If we're saying are you in the model or not, I do not understand, and I am unhappy about, if you look at paragraph 15.2 in that same document, the proposal to add language that talks about reassessment. I think we had the basic point about you see whether or not you're in the model, and if you conclude that you're out of the model, you reassess whether or not you qualify yet for the model. And I think that's the basic point here. If we, with the language that's proposed to be added to 15.2, it throws up a lot of red flags in my mind about whether we are bringing in something that's more than the basic. Do we have a contract with commercial substance that we were talking about qualitatively back in 12E, and now we're talking about qualitatively, you know, collectability specifically in the proposed paragraph 12F. So that to me is a problematic, not just drafting point. With that exception, would be happy to go with the staff suggestion if that's the way to bring us together and keep us together and convert the qualitative to more explicit.
Stephen.
That's what Mary said about bringing together. We're not really coming together, are we? Because we're using the same word, but we mean something different, which concerns me. I mean, I guess, you know, it's not my preferred solution. I don't think it fits with the model, but I guess I agree with Daryl that it's an acceptable compromise, particularly given what the meaning of the word probable is under IFRS. So I'm willing to go along with it, but it doesn't seem to achieve conversion.
You know, it's all a question of business culture. Okay. Can I see here who supports both proposals by the staff, so both the drafting and the collectability?
Right, over to you.
Sure. Can. With respect here, who agrees with the drafting changes by show of hands? We're gonna have this question, drafting threshold, and then I'm gonna actually ask the question, what threshold do we want? So who agrees with the drafting changes? That's 5, 1 no, 1 abstention. Okay, with respect, who agrees with the having a collectability threshold? Okay, 5 yes, 1 no, 1 abstention. So now it seems like we have two potential thresholds. We have probable, as we think of in U.S. GAAP, and then we have probable as it is thought of in IFRS, which I think is more likely than not in U.S. GAAP. So I'm going to call a vote. Who wants the threshold to be probable in U.S. GAAP versus more likely than not in U.S. GAAP? Okay? So who is for probable? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, that's 5. And you would prefer more likely than not? Okay, all right. So it's 5 for probable, 1 for more likely than not, 1 abstention. Okay. Okay, so I think that concludes all of the potential discussions today, correct? Okay, So I think, other than this minor difference as to the threshold, I think we are substantially converged, and I understand this is the last joint meeting on this. We have an additional what I hope to be one FASB meeting to deal with some conforming changes, which will happen in the next few weeks. And there we will actually, at that point, we'll call a formal final vote of the FASB. And then I think both boards will proceed towards drafting and completing this project. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, Russ, and I would really like to take this opportunity to thank the staff because we put them through an excruciating period in which they had to work very hard to keep the board members from going all over the place. And they finally presented us with very workable solutions, and I think we should be really grateful.
Hans, okay. I have a question. I just wanted to ask a question. All these changes obviously are not insignificant, and the knock-on consequence, obviously, by the time you get the document in a shape for us to review, significant amount of time has passed since you took the decision about the transition and mandatory effective date. Are you planning to bring that decision back to us?
I'm not sure. We'll have to just sort of see how long it takes.
Hey, Allison, we lost your sound.
It wasn't me.
We thought what you were saying was kind of important. So.
I was just saying, I think it'll depend on how long we it'll take for us to pull the document together. We'll probably flag that up for you in the drafting process, and then if we need to bring it back, we can. But I just highlight at this point that I think for the ISB, we took a decision back in May that the board gave us permission to ballot, and we sort of asked for dissent. We're just going to update that document and bring it back to you in November just to make sure that we're all okay with where we are. So we'll ask that question in November just with an explanation of where we've come. It'll be an ISB only, similar to the FASB, just to make sure we're all okay with where we are.
Don't underestimate our ability to reopen cases.
I never said you have cold cases.